I'm not sure if we were on for part of the record or not, so we'll start over again and bring this meeting to order on Wednesday, March 11th of House Education. It's now 8:07. President, our Representative Keller, Gardner, Book, and Chair Seaton. Representative Wilson is excused. Representative Edgman will join us later. He had a conflicting appointment. And today we're going to be mainly talking about the dropout situation, graduation rates, and what we can do in that field. We also, so that'll be the roundtable. The first thing we're going to do, though, is we have distributed a clean copy as requested of the House Bill 126 with the amendments included yesterday for everybody's perusal. And so I want to bring that up first and see if we have questions on that CS. Seeing none, we have House Bill 126. Representative Gardner, would you move this CS for our discussion?
I'd be delighted to. I move House Bill 126 version
P.
P?
Yes.
For discussion.
Thank you. And I'll object for the discussion of the bill. So we now have the CS that we gathered all the amendments from last and incorporated from last meeting. So are there comments on the bill? Representative Keller.
Yeah, I just want to say that the sponsor came and we talked at length about some of the questions in my mind. The questions are not totally resolved, but he has made a commitment to me to work on in the next committee. And if we hit a issue that's related to education that we can't handle, we'll send it back to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keller, and we're on. I'm on that committee with you as well, I appreciate that concern. Are there any other comments on 126? Can I have a motion to move?
Yeah. I move House Bill 126 from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Thank you, and that is version P that was before us. Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, House Bill 126, version P, will move from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. And now we have another subject, and that is House Bill 172. House Bill 172 was assigned to our committee. However, it's a companion to House Bill 109 that we passed out on student loan corporation being able to sell bonds. This is the interim measure for a borrowing from the state so that those student loans can be made this year. And so this is a temporary interim measure that's a companion of the bill we have already passed. Distributed the bill to everyone. And I'd request that we waive it from committee and get it to finance, because at this point this is purely a temporary finance measure. Is there any objection from the committee members? Do they want to?
Mr. Chair, yeah. I have a question. I don't understand the actual strategy. We can get this through quicker than the entire bill?
This takes
the underlying 109.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. This allows money on a temporary basis to be borrowed from the state and provides immediate funds so that they can be loaned. The other bill takes care of our longer term program in changing the credit rating so that we can sell bonds, but it would be a procedure of selling bonds, and until they sold bonds, received the money, they wouldn't be taking loan applications from students now, because they wouldn't know if their bonds would be successful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And so in these tight times, that's what that's about. So I'll just distribute this for, we've talked to Representative Wilson via phone because she's excused, and she has agreed to waive it from committee. If there's anyone that objects to waiving this from committee, of course we'll hold it. Otherwise, we'll waive this from committee on floor session on Thursday. So that was the other piece of business that I had before we got started with our roundtable. Are there is there anything else to come before the committee from committee members? I wanted to recognize that Representative Munoz has joined us. Thank you, Representative Munoz. And today, then, we have a our subject is with the department and with some invited guests, and to look at the dropout rate across the state, what dropout means, what graduation means, getting to the core of things as well, and then what we have been able to do and what we're attempting to do to lower that dropout rate. And so if the members would look at their packets, you'll see that we've got a pretty big packet there, but the first page, if and I'm doing this presuming that, you know, many of us may have looked at this information, but it's a big packet, so I want to put it on the record. The first thing is the average daily membership history of districts, and I brought another pair of reading glasses if anybody needs them, because it's really tiny print, of course. 1988 through 2008. The one that's labeled 2, and those are just circled. They're not the page numbers. They're the circle numbers.
Chair?
Yes. Representative Book, thank you.
I'll take you up on that.
Thank you. Page number 2 is the total statewide enrollment by ethnicity, grade, and percent in 2007. And then the same thing, number 3 is for 2008. Number 4 is the dropout rates in Alaska. And so we'll be discussing these, I'm sure, with the department, but it's one question we'll need to ask is a student who did not attend, who did attend and didn't receive a diploma, were they also a dropout? So they termed out through their participation but didn't. And then number 5 is all of the different districts and their dropout rate history from 1990 through 2008 by number of dropouts and the percentage. And in the smaller districts, of course, there's a greater percentage change for every single single one. Number 6 is dropout rates by ethnicity, again by year. Each year has a different sheet. Number 7 is graduation rate fact sheet, and I think we'll probably be covering more on that. Number 8 is the graduation rates by school district in 2008, and the graduation rates by subgroup in 2008 is number 9. Dropout count, students with IEPs 2004 through 2006. That was a request by, I believe, Representative Gardner had asked for information on that. And then 11 is further breakdown on dropout groups 2005 through 8. And then we have some general notes on the graduation rate meeting. That's number 12 from the Education Early Development Department. Then we have notes on why do schools leave. Group 1, brainstorming. The notes, why do students leave. Group 2, brainstorming. And finally, number 15 is the notes on ideas for immediate strategies. So just so the public is fully aware of the packet that we have and the information that we may be considering. We have, let's take just a brief at ease. So for the participation in our roundtable, we have Eric McCormick from the, you want to come on up and grab a chair. And the recording secretary said she's positioned the mics, so she thinks that we won't have to touch them. We can just speak towards them with the two mics. It should cover everybody. Tom Morgan. And that glue that you have, communities and schools, is from the group that Tom represents. Roberta Bush. Brad Flush. Fletch. And Sasha Sotoloff. And sorry if I'm getting these names, but I need more glasses, I guess. And Carl Rose. Carl, are you here? Yeah. And then online we have Karen Martinson from Sitka.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And so we're just getting started. You've heard the materials that we have before us. And so let's just start with what I'd first like to do is start with, you know, what is graduation? And so hopefully the department can get us what we measure and what are we trying for here before we get to, what are we failing to achieve? So let's see, department, can you fill us in on across the state? Are the standards or are the conditions set statewide? Are they set by individual districts? Are they pretty uniform across the state? And what is the requirement? Thanks.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Eric McCormick. I'm the Director of Assessment, Accountability, and Information Management with the Department of Education and Early Development. We have the high school graduation qualifying exam as a requirement for graduation, which measures proficiency in reading, writing, and mathematics. We have a statewide requirement of 21 units, 21 credits, which requires 4 years of English, 3 years of social studies, 2 years of math, 2 years of science, and we also have Alaska history as a requirement. That is a minimum requirement for districts. We do have districts that have more than 21 units.
Okay, and can you describe for us what a unit is?
A unit would, sorry, Mr. Chair. A unit would be what's traditionally known as a Carnegie unit, a credit for completion of coursework.
And is that measured by semester or by year, or is that measured by, how is it measured?
Mr. Chair, typically it would be a year. Credit would be a full year. Half credit would be a semester.
Okay. Representative Boot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In times past, when we have some kind of a phenomenal student, some of these kids are in college sometimes by the time they're 13, 14. How does that occur? Are we able to waive some of these through testing, or is there a certain, for an exceptional student, we ought to be able to advance them beyond these basic requirements. I wonder how that's done.
Okay. To the Chair, Representative Book, I can assure you that most of the advanced students are meeting the requirements, and they are also supplementing their education, maybe with statewide correspondence often, or with additional courses through the district. I cannot speak to any substitutions for credit requirements. I can find out more information on that for you. But generally, those students that are also pursuing maybe their AA or they're already enrolled in college are typically already achieving those district requirements as well as the state credit requirements.
And following up on what Representative Book is talking about, I really want us to get to the basic foundation also of what we are expecting and what we are valuing in students, because we seem to have two different things that we're talking about. One is competency, which we only measure minimally as a requirement for graduation. The other is seat time or endurance. And it seems that the graduation certificate, the diploma, is based almost entirely on minimum competency and endurance. And 20 credits, 20, you know, how many half credits maybe, they're all based on, did you sit in a class for this length of time? Not, what was your competency in there? Did you have minimal competency with that criteria? And did you endure class time? And so I think that at some basic structure, you know, we are approaching dropouts, and hopefully that's what some of the stuff we're going to do today. Why are kids dropping out? But, you know, it's not, if it's not based on competency, if it's not based on goals, if it's not based on achievements, and that's what's being recognized, but what really is being recognized is, did you endure the full semester? Did you endure the full year in that named class, and therefore you got the credit? Didn't matter for graduation whether you got a C, a B, or an A. All you had to do was endure the class time. And, you know, we've got all these issues that we're trying to get down with dual credits, trying to get more material down to engage students. We have the commissioners come with the idea of the middle college, trying to get more things to engage students. But it seems that what we're trying to do is somehow dovetail in and make that somehow a meaningful time, but it's still the time is the graduation requirement. And so I think at some basic level, a lot of the things that we've been talking about as far as getting to engaging students, having them engaged, comes to engagement and competency and doesn't do seat time. And because seat time, as some people have been telling us, and maybe you folks will have the same opinion or not, people get bored or people just get frustrated. And if that's the case, you know, maybe we need to look at a different system and a different value in graduation. Because if our value in saying you graduated, that means that you endured for 20 credits, some districts 20 and a half, whatever it is, you are, you know, that's the value, that's the requirements. And so anyway, as we structure this kind of, I hope that we'll make this free flowing. I don't want to, you know, if you guys have things to say, I want you to make sure you know, raise your hand or something. We still need to conduct the conversation through the chair so we don't just start having private discussions. But that's one basic thing that I really want to talk about is, you know, are our incentives and what we're telling students are important by saying it's time served, not what you've learned for graduation. And so anyway, that's just one thing I want to throw out at the beginning so that we're not just talking about how do we address a certain population so that we can do something to have them endure seat time longer so that they can graduate, and if that, and what's the goal. So that's, I just want to throw that out as a basic underlying principle of, I want to figure out not only how do we keep kids into graduation, but how do we make graduation meaningful for through our school system. So, Representative Gardner, did you have something? Does anybody else? Representative Keller.
Just a question to hear your follow-up. You said we got the high school qualifying exam and we have the credits. And the high school qualifying exam is set up by the statutes as a minimum requirement. But the am I right, just confirm that the, or not, that the credit requirement, that's strictly out of regulations? And do you remember right off the top of your head what the statutory authority is for that, just to, so you know, so if we wanted to affect the amount of credits required, you know, where would we go as legislators?
Okay, through the chair, Representative Keller.
And one thing I would just like to do is, your all male voices and the recording secretary is going to go nuts. So let me do something first. Let me have you go go around first and introduce yourself and who you represent, and then following that, if each time you speak, if you just say your name so that the recording secretary isn't trying to figure out who it is. So, Carl, would you start with introduction of who you are?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Carl Rose, Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards.
Eric McCormick, the Director of Assessment, Accountability, and Information Management with the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you for having me here. Tom Morgan, State Director of Committees and Schools. We keep kids in school, make them stick like you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Brad Flitch. I'm the Alaska Native Brotherhood Grand President and President of A&B Camp 70.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and representatives. My name is Sasha Sobolev, a local Junoite. Been in education for 39 years from the bottom to the top, but I work with kids and learning in the classroom.
Great, and welcome to you all. And the Eddie, are you sitting in the seat back there?
I'm sitting back here.
Mr. Jeans has just joined us. So, thank you. So let me... I interrupted your answer to the question, so, but to just get the introductions, but Representative Keller, or one of you, repeat the question. So if you want to just repeat the question before we go.
There's someone online. You were doing introductions.
Yeah. And thank you. Before we do that, Karen, would you introduce yourself and who you are for the record, or who you represent?
Sure. Thank you. I'm Karen Martinson. I'm in Sitka. And I am here specifically to represent students who have dropped out.
Okay. Thank you, Karen. And now we're back to Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Representative Keller. I don't have the specific regulation with me. I can provide that to you fairly easily. I also want to take the opportunity to correct myself. The requirement that I mentioned for credits in science is actually 2 years. I believe I said 3 years. It's 2 years for science. But I can get that information to you immediately.
Okay. Thanks. So I guess the answer to the question was that those are in regulation. So if the committee wanted to address that, we can address that in statute, and the regulations would follow. Was that what your point was? Great, thanks. Representative Gardner.
We heard earlier this year that, from the Gila School District, Galena, the boarding school there, and as I understand it, they have a higher science credit, am I not mistaken, or is it Mount Edgecombe? One of them requires more science and math for graduation. Has there been a discussion of broadly increasing that requirement?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner. At this point, I'm not aware of those conversations. One thing I have been asked to research are what other requirements are in other states, and I'd be happy to share that information with you. But I'm not aware of any specific discussions yet about science.
Thank you.
And that was Eric McCurry. And so let's just go around and would you give us your perspective, Carl, and start off and just if you want to take a few minutes and just.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Carl Rose of the School Board Association. In your packet, there's an article that I wrote on our statement on dropout prevention. When we talk about dropouts, I guess I'd like to go back to some of your earlier comments about being able to endure the process and the seat time. I would share with you this way as a result of my own kids. I think the toughest class you ever take in school is the one that you try to get a passing grade out of. We all did that in college where we crammed for that passing grade. We weren't concerned about content. If you look at it from the standpoint of mastery, how you introduce your curriculum, the core of what you're dealing with the purpose of mastery, the grades just come. When you master the content, the grades come. But for so many years, we focused on grades, and we have lost, for many of us, kids lose interest because they're not pursuing mastery. That's just one philosophical point of view that I think, you know, when we talk about making schools more engaging, more interactive, more, exciting for a young person, the actual content that you're dealing with in many of these situations, the actual core content, you can't get anywhere else. We in Alaska, we've put together an educational system that is a pretty good system. The question is, are our young people prepared to take advantage of it? When I say prepared to take advantage, I'm going to ask for a little bit of latitude. And if you look at No Child Left Behind, and there are those who support it and those who'd like to see it done away with, I think one of the things that we did is, one of the things that we've done is we've identified the four subgroups in No Child Left Behind. They are the people who are not English language proficient, ethnicity, disability, and people who are socially and economically challenged. We've identified those groups, we've given them a name, but we haven't allowed the system to drill down and help those kids. The way schools are funded is through regular instruction. We are mandated by federal law to provide services to those who are disabled through special education. We have federal mandates that we have to meet. We have some state mandates that we have to meet. They come out of regular instruction. Whatever money is left is what we have to deal with these four subgroups. I just think about this. If you were to identify four subgroups that potentially will become your dropouts of the future, and we don't provide ourselves the opportunity to drill down and address those issues, well, we gave it a name, but we didn't do much with it. Okay. Secondly, if you have a world-class educational system, but the kids who come to your schools are not prepared to take advantage of it, it's a huge flaw in what you're doing. Just give you an example, and this is not for all kids, because kids who come, and the data will show you that the kids who come from middle-class families who enjoy real conversations with real people who may read to them and care for them, up against people who come from families who are poverty-stricken, who don't enjoy a decent socioeconomic opportunity, and whose parents may not value an education, those students, there's a different kind of vocabulary that they engage in. It's like, don't do this, stop, be quiet, go outside and play. And when you add it all up by the time they go to school, there could be a variance of 2 to 3 million words and characters that a middle-class child coming out of an appropriate setting will have over that of a child who's been deprived that opportunity purely because of where they came from. Now, at kindergarten, when you introduce a child to a formal learning setting, you have some kids who are prepared to take advantage of that educational system. You have other kids who are ill-prepared, and as a result, by the time they hit the third grade, our third grade benchmark, you'll find that there are deficiencies that would render children being able to take advantage of an educational system or take advantage of a remedial system by the third grade. And as the curriculum steepens, those who are prepared will rise with the curriculum, and those who don't will start to see the gap. And all the data will show you that. From the third grade benchmark is where the gap starts. And unfortunately, it continues all the way through because you're playing catch up. You're remediating a child. So these are, so there are some societal issues here that come right along with the preparation for a quality education. Now, included in all that, we need to make our schools more interesting, more engaging. We need to deal, you know, we need to do more work with our professionals and how we engage our communities. And many people will say that schools cannot do this alone. We need our communities. We need our parents. You know, we need people who care enough about their children to take an active role. in their child's education, because if no one values that education, why are children going there? So I'm going to cut my comments short and let some of the others speak. I've submitted some testimony to Senator Murkowski last November, and it's reproduced in this document here. But this issue of dropouts, there are a number of reasons why people drop out. Some because they're not challenged, some because they're not prepared. And as a system, we have identified areas of great concern, like those four subgroups, and we are using those four subgroups and their performance to actually label schools. And as we start to label schools, you know, schools appear to be good or bad based on what they do on AYP. And I would leave you with this thought. If your measurement, if what you're measuring and your measurement is off, what does that have to do with how well your schools are? So there are some things, before you start to look at sanctions and start to categorize schools, we should take a look at what we're measuring and what we're trying to accomplish. We've been trying to do this on a national level with the National School Board Association. There are some efforts to rewrite some of this No Child Left Behind so that it makes sense. The whole idea being is No Child Left Behind is a good thing. It's good to know what you're accomplishing. It's good to have an idea of what your target is and what kind of progress you're making. But if your measurement is off, it creates more problems than it does help. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I think I'll stop for now, let some of the others talk, and then we'll engage in a conversation as we go.
And Representative Gardner and Boot and Keller.
I want to thank you very much for your comments. I feel like it's kind of put into a format all the little wisps of thought that have been sort of percolating in my own understanding. And what I think you're getting to is adequacy of education and what the Department of Education has the tools and the mandate to address, as you say, sort of misses the rest of the pieces, the disability, the social and economic challenges, the language issues and ethnic issues, and those four things the Department of Education is not mandated directly to even focus on, but state government is. I mean, that's part of our role, and you've given me kind of a structure for thinking about those elements. So thank you very much. It had a lot of impact on me.
Reverend Boop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question got answered.
Okay. Reverend McKellar.
Carl, I've come to really respect and appreciate you over the years, and I thank you. From a legislative perspective, you know, the heart and the concerns are exactly like yours. If you were a legislator and you knew you'd get something passed, how would you tackle this? I mean, where it's a cultural underpinning thing that's there, you know, what would you suggest would be the most expedient way to spend our time trying to fix this?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I think potentially our most expedient way, as I've reviewed most of the information, is how do we prepare kids for success? And that would be a general comment. Whether it's you've been identified in these subgroups or whether you're a young learner coming to the system, whatever we can do to help our children get on step so that they can take advantage of this educational opportunity is where you'll get your best bang for your buck. And there's a lot of discussion right now about early childhood development. That means a lot of things. That doesn't mean, you know, is some formal early childhood class where we teach three-year-olds a kindergarten curriculum. Early childhood development means a lot of things. It means everything from Head Start through some of your early development groups that are providing services. The point I'm trying to make here is that if kids cannot get what they need, you know, in their families or at home, and the data shows us this, how do we go about doing this without creating another bureaucracy that consumes an awful lot of the resource which some kids already have? I mean, it's a real challenge. I would just say this. If you had kids who had tremendous needs and you spread money out across the spectrum, you're actually taking money away from those kids who have special needs, and you're giving it to kids who may not have those needs. So when I talk about early childhood development, I'm looking at what kids need and what kind of programs and initiatives can be put in place within communities to help those kids. And that's how I would go about it. It would be at the early spectrum, but I don't think we want to move into something that is structured where this is the only option that you have. More options for families to get their kids up to speed is what we need.
Follow up, Representative Kelsey.
I just want to say for the record, if I could, something that I think you'd agree with and it needs to be there, is the best thing we can ever possibly do for our kids is to, you know, if they got parents that care for them and read to them. And I mean, that the data is just overwhelming that a child that has loving, caring parents does well, and one that doesn't struggles, you know. And that's, you know, so I really appreciate your comments, and it's a really a challenge for us to try to figure out how to do something that isn't a program that tries to fill that gap that we see is there with some of the kids. So, thanks.
Carl, I wanted to just address something a little bit here. You know, we've got the four subgroups that we talk about, and we can talk about disabilities or whatever, but then we're rolling in kids that aren't exposed to a lot of words, that come together with a different set of values when they come to school. And I know it's not only the cultural is probably one of the easiest ones to pick up as a measurement, not as a degrading anything, but there are, you know, a lot of cultural differences in our state, and in some the value, and in some areas of the state, the value is not on kids talking and being vocal. They're supposed to be observers. They're supposed to be visual learners, and yet, and some of that's cultural as to whether, you know, we're valuing the kid's first word, and that's the thing that we do in middle class, you know, Caucasian society. I mean, and in other societies, kids are supposed to be observing and watching. And so it's almost like we're taking students that have a different cultural perspective, and that may be a different cultural perspective in all those ethnic groups, and bringing them and saying, okay, now you are going to learn by this auditory method of these words, and that's it. Whereas if they were blind, a disability, we wouldn't say, oh, well, you've got to see these words and do it. But if there's a difference there, how are we, it seems like we've got, you know, the square peg in the round hole kind of thing, and it seems like at some point we need to back up and address where we're going and how we're going to get there, and whether we are basically saying we don't value observation and visual learning, we're valuing auditory learning as the only thing we're kind of doing. And does that relate to how we present and how we work with education, getting them to that third grade level where this split, if everything is auditory and that's not what's necessarily valued in the home? It doesn't mean that the parents don't love the kids. It's just that there's a, you know, there could be a value placed on visual learning and that kind of thing. So can you address that just a little bit?
Yes, I can. I guess I'd start by, in fact, when I gave this testimony. As a young boy, I was in all four subgroups. I'm Hawaiian. We spoke Pidgin English. We didn't speak regular English where we grew up. I'm dyslexic. I have a disability. And we were, I didn't realize we were socially, economically challenged. I don't think many of us did. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, through my early schooling, this is before IDEA, this is before itinerant teachers came in and worked with young kids. The option of having an education gave me a chance to learn, to conform, if you will, and get an education that would help me for the rest of my life. I think that that's something we owe to all young people, and we need to observe and be culturally responsive to young people. They've come to us from their families, many of which have generations of rich culture. It's not mutually exclusive. I think what we want to do is provide kids with an opportunity to be successful within, you know, our American economy, our capitalistic economy, and understand how things work and why it's important to be able to read, write, and compute as a matter of course. But there's also a lot to learn about the people we live with. We all come from different cultures. I mean, the educational system here in America is rich, but I think a lot of it gets drained down by a six-hour school day and 180 days, and, you know, I can go on and on. The fact of the matter is that when people come to a system and they're challenged somewhat, can we find ways to help them get through those barriers so that they can partake of what we've prepared for them? And across America, you see those success stories. But we find that in some of our schools, and, you know, in some of our states, you know, and even in some of our classrooms, when we don't deal with children and their immediate challenges, and we ignore those, they become problems, they become obstacles, they become reasons why people leave. So I guess that's the best example I can give you. A culturally relevant education is what we should be offering to all kids so that they observe where they come from. We don't want to erase that. This is not an assimilation effort. But we do want them to have that rich opportunity to get an education. I'll stop there.
Okay. Did you have a presentation that you want to make for the department?
Mr. Chair, I do. I have the majority of the packet comes from our dropout prevention meeting, and I think I can get through that rather quickly.
Yeah, that would be great.
Also, before we start, I've located the regulation for the high school graduation requirements.
Okay. That's fine.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, this would be 4AAC06075.075.
Thank you.
Okay. In February 19th and 20th, we were brought together by our Commissioner of Education. We had a dropout prevention group, and we had representatives from CIS, Tom Morgan here to my left. We had school district representation. We had state board members. And we had someone there from Anchorage's Promise. The focus of this was to identify, first of all, reasons for why Alaskan kids are leaving our public school system. We're trying to find a more appropriate word than dropout. Dropout's the accepted word, but we're trying to find it. It's such a broad population of kids. Commissioner Ledoux started off the meeting talking about the new three R's of education, being rigor, relevance, and relationships. As we were doing our brainstorming activities, we were asking each participant to break our factors into four categories, one being student, second being school, third being family, and fourth being community. The one topic that repeated itself through the four was relationships and the need for kids to connect with an individual, a mentor, a teacher, somebody, or an activity. We talked about the need for activities to keep kids not only motivated but keep them engaged. Paraphrase Mr. Rose, and I'll probably butcher this, but something he said earlier about in his document about there being a need for kids at the end of the school day to be motivated and to want to come back the next day. I think that's very important. In education, we talk about the golden T in a classroom. That's the front row of kids in the classroom, and then right down the middle. we need to have our classrooms connect with every single kid in that classroom. We talk about the invisible kids, the kids that aren't making connections, kids that are just getting by. Those are the ones that are right on the verge. It won't take much to get them out of the loop. Once a kid becomes credit deficient in high school, it really is tough to make it back. I think what we had hoped in this meeting to get to was to develop next steps for strategies and how to recover and retain these kids. We had in-depth conversations about strategies. We're not quite there, but we are planning on meeting again in combination with the dropout symposium by the ASDN group, and I believe that meeting is happening again in April. Do we have time really quickly for me to go through some of the board? Okay. I'll go down as they are numbered in contents. The numbers 1 through 9 were provided for this dropout prevention meeting. And we went through to identify what a dropout is, how our dropout and graduation rates are calculated. And since this meeting, I've dug a little deeper to find out numbers within the numbers on these pages. The first three, the average daily membership and the enrollment, we wanted to provide that as perspective. So when we're looking at the number of dropouts and graduates in districts and statewide, we wanted to give you an idea of the perspective of how those numbers relate. If we go to number 4, dropout rate fact sheet, first of all, to address your question, a child who completes the school year and receives a certificate of attendance, in our system they're not identified as a dropout. However, in the graduation rate, which I will get to, they are weighted in the denominator the same as a child that dropped out. So we measure in Alaska for dropout rates, we measure grades 7 through 12. I can also provide for you the rates that are 9 through 12. Generally, you can add about 2% to the 7 through 12 dropout rate. So as you see in looking at 2005 through 2008.
And we're talking about the middle of page 4, or the one that's labeled 4 in the upper right-hand corner. Okay.
Right. In 2005, we had close to 3,800 dropouts reported. You can see we've gone down to 2008 about 3,200. So we are making gains as far as limiting our dropout numbers. We are also included here. I have the Alaska Native American Indian dropout rate for perspective. That's something we are often. It's often requested from our office. If we can go next, I'm going to skip over the school district. It's probably hard to read. I apologize for the small type in there. If we go to item number 7, which would be the graduation rate fact sheet, it's arranged in the same type of format. You can see in looking from the 2004 school year where we had a little bit under 7,300 graduates, here in 2008 we're up to 7,855. So my point here is, in a time where we have declining and stagnant enrollments, the number of kids that we're issuing diplomas to is going up. And I think that's a direct result of school districts actively retaining, finding these kids that are one credit away, finding these kids that aren't quite there yet with HSGQE. I think we're just starting to find that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gardner.
I'm not sure that I completely see that. If we have the graduation rate in 2004 at 62.9% and we have it 62.6% in 2008, I don't see that we've made a big impact over those 4 years.
Okay.
The raw number itself measures the number of kids, but the percentage is the same.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's an excellent point. And the reason for the graduation rate staying pretty flat is because we do have a lot of other kids that are being thrown in the denominator that we're still trying to help that aren't quite there yet as far as the number of graduates. So we're increasing the number of graduates, but we're also not quite there getting all of the kids that may be in their fourth or fifth year through the system. So in other words, our denominator is growing a little bit faster than our numerator in the calculation. Is that
No.
Mr. Chair.
Karen, I believe that was you. Go ahead.
It was. Thank you. Karen and Sitka. Could you take sheet number 4 and number 7? And I'm just looking at them side by side. So I see a dropout rate of 5 or 6 or 8% and a graduation rate of 62%. Can you add those up for me and help me figure out where I'm missing? If we only have 6% dropout and only a 62% graduation rate, then where's the other 30%?
Okay. Mr. Chair, 40%. I can address that. The dropout rate is an event dropout rate of a single year. It's the number of kids that were identified that dropped out during the school year divided by the entire population for that same group. The graduation rate is a measure over 4 years. So what it tells us is 63% of the kids are getting through in 4 years. If we were to take the 9 through 12 dropout rate, again, which I'd be glad to provide, about 8%. If you took 8% for the 4 years, it gets about 32. That gets us close to 100%. But these statistics are collected separate of each other and reported separately. But the 4-year graduation rate is a measure of what percentage of kids get through in 4 years. So it does not address the kids that are getting through in their 5th and their 6th year.
I see.
Yes.
Representative Boot.
Through the chair, thank you. I think I understand what your dilemma is regarding some of your stats. Have you changed the structure in these 4 years as to the way that you're accumulating your data as well?
Through the chair, Representative Book, absolutely. In fact, we are starting in 2011, we are required with the new federal Title I regulations to go, we're going to have a new graduation rate that'll be comparable across the 50 states.
Reverend Boot.
So, in essence, we're comparing apples to oranges to a degree.
Through the chair, Representative Boot, absolutely. But when we first came up with this graduation rate, we didn't have access to student level data, and when we used, if we look at. We look at item number 9, you see we have the number of graduates, the number of continuing 12th graders, the 12th grade dropouts, and then we have the 11th grade dropouts from the previous year, and we go back to the freshman year. Those were originally just counts that we received from the districts. We didn't have the student level information, so it was possible we had duplicates. Now we have the ability to identify individual students. So that as kids, if they drop out multiple times, or if they drop out and then they catch up with their cohort and actually graduate, they'll only be counted one time in the denominator. The focus on this graduation rate, again, which existed before we had the student level data, focus was starting with the seniors and working our way back 4 years, which was not an easy thing to do across all of our school districts. What the new graduation rate will measure is identifying the first year freshmen. And then from there, the clock is ticking. They have 4 years. It will be a much easier rate both to collect as well as to report, and makes much better sense. And I, the fact that we have the student level data, we can do this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. And Brad, did you have a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Just identify your name.
My name is Brad Flitch. And I don't have children in the school district. And I'm here because I'm on a joint grant between Tlingit and Haida Central Council and the Juneau School District, working on a dues or dropout early warning system. And the one thing, and this is a great time to interrupt these gentlemen and point out the level of resources being used to work on a formula. I was in this meeting, and we watched a webinar. It was held, I think, up in Fairbanks, and there was close to 70 state employees or school district employees flew in for a meeting to discuss ad nauseum the numerators and denominators. If we would actually apply these resources to educating children as opposed to debating formulas, we would be infinitely better off. I would ask this body to look at how much of our state resources is spent on non-education. You will be absolutely floored by the amount of money we're spending flying people all over the state to discuss who should be in the numerator and who should be in the denominator. It is ridiculous. Thank you.
Okay. And you want to...
Mr. Chair, if I could share one more statistic, sure. and then we can move on. In looking at the graduation rate, back to the 12th grade students that are continuing, which could either represent a kid who receives a certificate, they haven't passed HSGQ yet, but they've met the district requirements, or a kid who doesn't have either but is expected to continue, we tapped into that number, and we found that 69% of those kids had actually passed all three parts of the HSGQE. So more than two-thirds of the kids that as a senior are not making it through in their fourth year and are expected to continue, over two-thirds of them have passed all three parts of the HSGQE.
So just a clarification, you mean then they pass that and they're not going to have the number of credits for whatever reason, they either failed a course or they didn't complete a course, moved between schools, didn't complete the seat time to have that. Is that what you're
meaning? Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Gardner.
That's kind of an interesting number, and we've heard that HSQED is basically 10th grade kids pass it, many of them. What is the value of that exam to this state?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, it's the million-dollar question. Value to us is it tells us that we do have a standard to meet, that we want all kids to be at a minimum level meeting. The results of the Moore case, we're looking, of course, closer at that, see if it's rigorous enough. Value of the HSGQE to me is to give kids to feel that they've accomplished something, to mean that our diploma actually represents something rather than just a piece of paper again for seat time.
But the question is, if it represents something they passed in their sophomore year, and that is so much of the psychological equivalence with that's the meaning of a diploma, other than, okay, you've got the qualification to get a diploma out, so now you just have to spend time in a seat and pass without failing the courses, and that's what I'm told that many of our kids see as our value in a diploma, and that's a real problem, you know, because if that's what the message we are sending kids is, hey, you passed your requirement to get out of here, you've got your content requirement, now you have to endure two or three more years and then you graduate. Has the department got any survey, or does anyone have any survey data from kids on how many think that they've already qualified and are ready to leave high school when they're juniors or whatever? Do we have anything like that?
Mr. Chair, at this point, I don't believe the department has, but that sounds like a very good topic for our upcoming April when we get back together, our dropout prevention group. I think we can put that together rather quickly to find that out. We did talk about the motivation for those kids that do pass it the first time in their 10th grade. I think that would be a great suggestion to go out to students and develop a survey.
And, you know, we're all working on policies as we go forward in time, and this is our policy. This is a legislatively mandated policy that there'll be a high-stakes test to make, and the idea was to, I think, make the diploma meaningful. And, you know, our consideration has to be at some point in time, does that make the the diploma meaningful if kids pass it when they're 10th. I mean, it does mean that they're, that an employer sees a Alaska graduation certificate or somebody checked, yes, they did graduate. That means that they passed that test. And the only question is, does that give an employer much information if they know what this test is? And I don't know how employers are looking at people that passed the high school graduation test and didn't, or whatever we want to call it, and how they regard that. But go ahead, Representative Keller. But that is something that we would like data back on or information back on from how both students and employers see the diploma if it has that, the test that we currently use attached to it. Representative Keller.
Yeah, I thank you, Mr. Chair. When the high school qualifying exam was put in place in statute, I was a staffer for Senator Dyson, and it was fascinating to me that the department came forward with some recommended standards that were quite a bit higher than what ultimately were accepted as the standards for the high school qualifying exam. It was just a fascinating thing to see the pressure that was put on the legislature for keeping the standards down so that everybody could pass it. And so, you know, the fact that it has become the standard for getting out, is the irony is huge, you know, and we need to address it. But I want to just, for the record, say that, legislatively, there is a need to have a value for the diploma, so that it's worth something when you go out to the workplace and show it. And that was the intent, anyway, of the establishment, as I remember it, of putting in the test.
And that's a question that's come up a lot, whether that minimal test does tell employers anything, or whether we need a graduation diploma that has, you know, competency evaluations or criteria testing, you know, what level you are at in math or science or something else, so that if you're talking about someone using that graduation certificate for some other reason, that people have an idea of the amount of competency that the student obtained. So, Representative Book and then Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On Representative Keller's point, not without putting words in Mr. Rose's mouth, I think some of the value has to be from the student. The student as well has to have a value of that graduation. Not necessarily that it's a piece of paper or it's a credential, but in achieving that goal is the value. If I may paraphrase what you said.
Right. Okay, and we also have Don Shackleford joined us online from Avant Garden. I know that Tom Morgan has to leave here shortly, so I wanted to make sure that we're going to skip over to you, Tom.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that.
Just saying, Representative Gardner.
Some of these have been touched on before, but I just want to make sure that we all understand we're on the same page here, that given the requirements of No Child Left Behind testing, look, my question is, and this is kind of rhetorical, but somebody may want to answer it in their things, I don't see that we gain anything by retaining a second series of testing. And maybe somebody will disagree. It seems that we've also inadvertently created a disincentive for kids to continue after they've passed all those three tests. And when we talk about the satisfaction and the sense of competency in having passed this test in 10th grade, I don't understand how that would supplant the satisfaction and competence of having passed 4 years of high school English classes. And I would say, I'd posit, that if any student who passes 4 years of English classes and can't pass, can't be assumed to have been capable of passing the test in 10th grade, where we have a real disconnect here. There's something completely wrong with the system. So, but the question that comes to me is, do we have any idea how many kids in this state can meet all their high school graduation requirements except passage of the high school graduation qualifying exam in all its parts?
And I think that we have that information, so we'll have the department get back to us on that to get that specific number. So, Tom, would you go ahead?
I know you have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. I'm always impressed with the level of discussion and expertise that's prevalent within rooms like this, and I thank you for being allowed to be a part of it. My remarks would be very simple and just say ditto, and we're here to help, and probably move on, because that's really the gist of communities and schools, is to help remove barriers to kids, to learning, to graduating from school. But if I may, because I'm an old retired Navy chief that forgets easily, I'd like to read a couple of prepared remarks that I was pleased to join with Mr. Rose and others testifying at the hearing mentioned back in November. I'm preaching the choir. National research has shown that students who do not finish high school earn less pay less tax, rely more on public health, are more involved in the justice system, and are more likely to be involved in the welfare system. CIS of Alaska strives to work closely with school districts around the state. Like glue, we mobilize and connect resources with the schools, better enabling them to stick with it and stay in school. As a statewide network in dropout prevention, we are committed to success through collaboration, and that is key. Now, how do we know we're doing this? We do this because a lot of people have paid a lot of money, a lot of words, to look at whether or not things like communities and schools make a difference, and they do, and I have some data that I'll provide to you to prove that. I don't need to regurgitate that here. I can tell you that we broker and mobilize in an effective, coordinated way existing resources. Let me say that again. Existing resources that already exist in the community, and invite those resources into the school. It saves valuable dollars while improving efficiency of delivery and the services to children and youth, and helping remove those barriers I mentioned. Through these school-based affiliate programs and statewide initiatives, CIS Alaska is creating a network of social services, businesses, community resources, and volunteers that work together. Our statewide initiatives, Career Exploration Opportunities, CEO, an interactive distance learning center exploration program targeted at rural youth, and the Imagination Library and Early Literacy Program for children birth to five are being well received. Our dream, our call to action, if you will, is to formulate support to implement the CIS model and provide a CIS coordinator, maybe better called a graduation coach, in every school in Alaska, whereas the children's needs can be met to help keep them in school, and teachers are free to teach. I was impressed, and I've heard this more than one time, that from principals around the state and around the nation as I travel, you, CIS, allow me and my teachers to teach. We need to clone the CIS coordinator, the graduation coach. As stated earlier, like glue, we mobilize and connect these resources with schools, better enabling students to stick with school and stay in school. Support by federal and state government will allow us to expand our existing sites and offer the opportunity for many more communities, especially rural communities, the ability to experience the positive outcomes we can provide for youth. We have a program that has proven success in preventing dropouts. Dollar for dollar, CIS of Alaska offers the right investment in our children's future. We look forward to partnering with you, and partnering is another key to that collaboration. We're not the end to all ends. We don't profess to be. But we are an agency that has the ability to reach out to the community, and others more astute than I have mentioned that before. We need to do that to provide the children an ability to get through the myriad of challenges and barriers they have, whether they're artificial barriers, barriers they put in place themselves, barriers at home. The schools cannot be expected to be the answer to all of it. But we can help with that, and you can help, and we just want to be part of that solution. Thank you for the time to be here.
Thanks. And before I get to the other questions, would you just give me an example of, are you working with individual students?
Sure.
Let's say just an individual example of existing resources and how you glue those together in the school, and if you're working with an individual student or a full classroom, or what that entails.
I'd be pleased with that, Mr. Chairman. Probably the most simple way I could put that is, the first thing we do is we go into a school, as we sit down with the school and the kids and say, what are your needs? What are the needs that are not being met? Once we identify that, it could be something as simple as Mrs. Morgan in the fifth grade saying, little Jimmy's can't concentrate in school because his teeth hurt, and he doesn't have any kind of dental insurance. Well, that's, believe it or not, is a pretty easy fix. That's a matter of going to the dentist out in town saying, gee, we have this challenge, would you do some pro bono work and help with that? And it's a classic one, it's a simple one, and it works. Now all of a sudden he's not worried about his teeth hurting, he can focus on school. So that's maybe a simplistic approach, but it's one that happens every day we do it. Kids come to school hungry. Okay, we can usually help that with various Title I program stuff through Head Start and Lunch. What happens over the weekend? Home Depot, for a number of years at CS sites around the nation, have provided a backpack program. They start out with supplies for school. But guess what happens? That morphs into a situation where before that child leaves on a Friday afternoon, he's provided his backpack, but there's some food in there to get him over the weekend. It's simple things like that. So it's identifying individual needs, but working with the school and then working with the community. And let's face it, there's lots of resources, a lot of good people out there, a lot of good nonprofits, faith-based community organizations, grandma and grandpas that want to help. They just want to know how. And they can use community schools as that conduit to the school in a coordinated way. We say integrated network delivery system. That scares people. But the reality is it makes it more effective, more efficient. Agencies find out that one agency is working with mom and dad, another agency is working with son, another agency is working with daughter, but they don't know that they're all working with the same family. Just get them around the table, three of them find that out, four or five agencies. Now all of a sudden they work together, they don't duplicate, it's more effective, more efficient, and my goodness, those barriers, and some of them quite simple barriers, are removed. I hope that answers your question, sir.
Yes, yeah, thanks, that's helpful. Reverend Keller, and then Gardner, and then Book.
I just want to come in, CIS. Your website is great, you know, and I went on and looked at it. And I just, I think it's just great to go in there and identify the assets in the community, at the community level, and be a resource manager for those kids. The vision of CIS has really impressed me, and I just commend you, and that you continue on, and thanks. Your graduation coaches, how are they paid?
Through a combination of funding, either state or federal. What we see happen is usually communities and schools will get some seed money to go in and show the principal and the superintendent that the model works. And because that works, then it's usually integrated into the school system, and again, through a combination of funding. As a nonprofit, opens up opportunities for us to go out and maybe access some dollars that wouldn't normally be available.
Just a quick follow-up.
I see a lot of similarities between what you do and what Carl Rose and the Association of School Boards did, identifying the assets that a kid has and working with it. But I think the magic that is finding the person in the community that cares about the kid, and that is great. Thanks.
Through the chair, yes, sir, Representative Gallagher, we work very closely on that. And the key is that individual, and again, we call it a CIS coordinator, call it a graduation coach, call it a dropout prevention specialist, a lot of different names. But the reality is it's that individual that school administrator, that teacher, can tap on their shoulder and say, I have this need, can you help me? And that person, by virtue of their knowledge of the community and a lot of agencies, can usually pretty quickly reach out and find that entity or call someone and say, gee, who do you know? You know, we're a small state when it comes to a situation like that, and it's not, I'm sure you've been in that situation, you get a phone call, and boy, don't you feel good when you say, yep, I know someone can help with that. We're pleased that we can say yes. We just want the opportunity to say yes more often.
Great. And Tom, I know you got to leave, so quickly.
Okay.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. My question also relates to graduation coaches, and it seems to me that what they're doing falls under the bailiwick of the school counselor, who deals with kids' personal issues, social issues, whatever comes up in the course of the day, including providing snacks and foods. I think lots of school counselors have that, and the academic scheduling issues. So would we not? I mean, how is a graduation coach different from the role of a school counselor?
Yeah. Through the chair, excellent question. I would suggest to you that some of what you said is right on, but it's also very much within the school. I think we take it a step further by going out in the community and bringing those things and taking some of that challenge off the shoulders of the school administrator, who has a lot of other options, a lot of other things they have to work on. So I see a distinct difference there, but I also can see why someone would look at that and say, gee, there's a duplication. And I would suggest to you there really isn't. it allows the administrator, allows the educator to concentrate on the education component of it, and the other barriers to success outside their purview, that's where we can bring the community resources into play. And I'd be pleased to talk to you more on that, but I think I could make a case for you that would more clearly define, without the limited time we have here, the difference between that. Because you're making a good point, and you're right on. There's some very distinct areas. We're just saying that there's some things that, sure, the counselor, the principal could certainly do that. But is that the best use of their time, and is that what they should be doing, or can they allow someone else to help them do that? And we think that that's a better model to use, and we have some of the data to show that it does work.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'd consider maybe we just need counselors with smaller caseloads.
That's another whole matter, but yes, sir.
And many schools do not have counselors at all. Right. All the elementary schools and many high schools as well. Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Morgan, 2 years ago I had the opportunity to sit in on a governor's conference. At that conference I learned in 3 days, probably the biggest takeaway there is one of the things that you touched on, and that's statewide coordination. If there was a means by which you could suggest that we could put these things together statewide, could you give us a recommendation before you leave here?
Through the chair, excellent question. The simple answer to me would be to put that graduation coach, that CIS coordinator, that individual in each school, at least a halftime person. That's what the model shows as being a high fidelity use of that. So to my, the short answer is put that person in there to allow them to help connect those dots between all the different agencies and stuff.
Follow-up, Representative Book.
Well, I understand your advocation for your particular entity. Sure. However, my interest from the state level is if somebody was to integrate some of your capabilities, who, at what level, should do that?
Through the chair, I think by virtue of the fact that we are invited to sit at some of the graduate committee through the UE that includes folks like Mr. Rose and that, we're at the table. I'm not the smartest person in the room, and some of these ideas and stuff I've stolen from other groups and organizations because they've done it right and it works. One example that we saw was in City of Richmond. City of Richmond went through a school there that was fed by 6 or 7 housing areas, so certainly socially economically depressed area. They had a community action group, and all of our communities and schools type sites have these committees, if you will. This one happened to consist of about 82 agencies, from grandma to social service agencies, whatever, working on issues and stuff affecting that school. So there's very much a coordination there of all of those state, federal, and local type entities. I would say yes to you, I was amazed to walk into this school, and the school was an old school, but it was clean. It was immaculate. You could see the pride that the administrators in the school and the kids took in that school. And oh, by the way, they had a 97% attendance. Now, the local DJ, his job was to get the pizza and the entertainment for the monthly attendance parties that they would have. Grandma's job was to be in the hallways, just to be there as a calming feature and someone that they could come up to and be that caring adult, building that relationship and that partnership that we've all talked about today.
Great. Thanks, Tom. And I know you have to run here, so Representative Book, and then we do need to.
So could we sum this up as to saying that this is kind of a community building requirement that has occurred in Richmond?
I think that's a fair observation. And the point maybe I left out was to the point that even social workers hired and paid by the City of Richmond are repositioned, and I'd never heard that word before, repositioned communities and schools to work in the schools because they could do the most good there and the most coordination of resources. So I think that's an excellent analogy, and I was seeing some nodding heads from some of my friends here, and I think that's probably what we've been working towards and are working towards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thanks, Tom. And
my pleasure.
We're going to save off on any more for the department because we can always get you back, and we have two other folks here. We want to make sure we get through their ideas and thoughts. So, Brad, did you have some further thoughts that you wanted to give us?
Yes. Thank you, Chairman. I'm not an educational professional. I'm just a person in the community, and I was asked to sit on this working group. It's a three-year, I think Cornell University is involved in it. So there's about 20, 25 of us from the local community that meets with the school district, and we've been just going through data. One of the things that I've noticed, and I'm challenged the school district. First of all, we need to understand one thing. These are public schools. That means you teach and educate who shows up. We have got to stop the blame the parent, blame the student campaign of the school districts. The school district's job is to educate those who show up at their door to a level that they are contributing members of society. This campaign of saying, well, it's the student, it's the parents, it's the home, that's really not the place of the school district. We have to end that. We have to end it now. It's causing as much problems as anything else. I will agree with the administration that we have to come up with a different name. The last nine or so pages, I sent an email out. I have a fairly large email network. And surprisingly, and a lot of the responses are included in your packet. They had never been asked. Those that drop out have never been asked, why did you leave? A lot of them were just shocked. One young gentleman in there, my wife is a writer, and she goes, he writes better than you do, Brad. You know, and I'm a college graduate and, you know, darn near master's level. So, I mean, it's not that these people aren't intelligent or incapable of learning. So you have to ask yourself why. Why is the school system failing? Has everybody ever asked what is the probability of someone dropping out of school because they have a really bad interaction with a really bad teacher? This is pioneering research, that if you have a really bad teacher in your first few years of school, your history. How do we get rid of these bad teachers? How do you identify the bad teachers? What is a bad teacher? We spend all of our resources trying to blame the parents and trying to blame the students, and we're not looking at the system itself. Incentive compensation is a big topic, especially in my industry, financial services. And I think about incentive compensation in the teachers. I asked Patty Bippas. She's the principal at the new high school at Thunder Mountain. I said, if you were to go to the Soprano High School and you knew that if a student dropped out, you would lose a knuckle, and every student that dropped out, you would lose another knuckle, would you change your teaching strategies? Yes. Would they all graduate? Yes. Okay. Would they all stay there? Yes. So obviously, it's not always just the student. It was interesting listening to the gentleman from the administration that we've got four categories and we know why these students are what they are. Those are tools for the education department. As a financial analyst, I have lots of tools that I analyze things with. I don't share them with the public because they don't care how I do my job or how the sausage is made. They want good tasting sausage. Are our school districts tolerate failure. Right now, approximately 3,500 students a year are dropped, not completing our education system within the guidelines we have designed. Mr. Morgan mentioned, you know, that they add to the negative costs of society. But let's think of it this way. That's 3,500 people every year not contributing $50,000 of economic activity in a positive way. That's $180 million of economic activity, positive economic activity, we're foregoing, potentially, and replacing it with expenses. We spend a vast amount of resources. Do you know how much Juneau School District pays per student per year? Our budget is $70,000 or $70 million for under 5,000 students. We're spending over $14,000 per year per student. That's shocking to me. And we can't graduate them. There's many reasons. Surprisingly, bullying is one of the most paramount ones I see. It's never one, it's always a portfolio of problems that usually tip. I think The Tipping Point would be a good book that we should understand, that at some level it falls over. It's a combination of issues. I really love the toothache idea, because surprisingly, even in Juneau, we don't provide transportation for all our students. And just transport, and you'll see that someone in there had mentioned that transportation is one of the reasons why they're unable to get to class on time. Or maybe that their family matters, you know, that they have to get younger siblings off and they can't leave for high school 2 hours before the elementary school kids do. You know, these are system problems. And they're only going to be addressed if we actually sit down and talk with the students and ask them. For the amount of money we spend, we have to do a better job. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad. Appreciate that. And, you know, I think that that's part of what we're trying to do here, is not just look at what little pieces, but our full incentives and our, you know, the what I was posing before is, what are our incentives, what are we asking, and what are our expectations, and what are the rewards? And, you know, Representative Keller was talking about that as well, as, you know, what does this test mean? Does it get us there? And so hopefully we'll stay in communications on this, because I think that we're all wanting to go towards that same goal, and it is the individual student. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. There's a Native Alaskan member of this body, and because I'm sort of paraphrasing what he said, I don't want to use his name, but he stood before a large group speaking about education issues and said, what is our responsibility, our being Native Alaskans? Why are we not sending our children to school? Why do we let our kids drop out, let our kids not go? And what is our role in this problem? And from what you're saying, I don't see that you would agree with what he said.
That's our responsibility, and we should probably take that amongst in a discussion in ourselves. In this forum, I'm talking about what the school district is failing to do for us, not what we're dealing with. What we're failing to do for ourselves.
Okay, but I think
Representative Gardner.
Follow up, thank you. And you talked about stop blaming parents and students. I'd like to take blame out of it, but as a parent, I had responsibilities towards my children's education. And one of the most important things somebody said to me when I first had very, very young children, and I was talking about homeschooling and what I wanted to do with them, somebody said to me, you cannot send your child to school every day, even if you send them every day and expect that 12 years later they come back to you educated people. You always, always have a role in that. And I took that very much to heart and realized that to the extent that if I was in the school as a volunteer, I would tell teachers, do not write me a thank you note. Do not even consider this help to you. I'm not here for you, frankly. I'm here for my kids because it benefits them. I recognize that. And I think that parents have a responsibility to be actively engaged in their children's education. And it doesn't necessarily mean in that classroom. You know, I mean, we all have roles in it. Everybody in the community has a role in it. And the district absolutely and the state have responsibilities. But nobody can do it by themselves, not any one agency or facility.
Reverend Munoz?
I have a question for Sasha Sobolev, who's an former administrator. I think you're still with the high school. Former administrator at the Gina Douglas High School. Sasha, recently I heard a statistic that failure in ninth grade PE is an indicator for future, you know, dropout or push out, however you want to call the term. But, you know, when I heard that, I was just so startled that might be a tangible factor in future failure. And just because of, well, how, you know, perhaps how preventable failure in PE is, but also the fact that they're competing goals, really. I mean, we want to give our kids good PE and you know, physical fitness throughout high school, but then we're also setting kids up into a situation where there's focus on, you know, body image and having to dress down and showering and, you know, having the best gym clothes or, you know, that kind of thing. And I was just so fascinated by that comment. Could you comment on that? Is there real data that's showing that correlation?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz. Appreciate the opportunity to comment. One of the key indicators of student success has always been whether or not they're able to survive the system, as we've generally come to agreement here. What PE is one of the facets of the determination of whether or not a student is going to be successful. Usually at that age group, your body's changing, got hormones going, you got all kinds of things going in a social context, and it is not, unless you're an athlete used to rough and tumble, push and shove, you know, you're not going to stand up to that kind of rigor in the locker room, in the PE class, and so it does oftentimes become an indicator. But what's even more startling is the general acceptance in the educational world, in high schools on secondary levels, particularly if you're talking about Alaska Natives, is the rule of thumb. And that rule of thumb is, if you survive your sophomore year, meaning you get 3 credits your freshman year, 3 credits your sophomore year, that you'll go on and graduate. If you don't, you're gone. And generally, over 60% of the minorities that go through our Alaskan schools fall into that category, where they fail to survive their sophomore year. PE is an indicator of one of those things because it is such a large determinant of whether or not you want to have, as a child or as a student, to go into that classroom to have to dress down, change in front of your peers, face whatever it is that goes on. And it is an indicator. One of the largest things that school districts will do to get around that is to offer summer PE, where you are able to get the PE credit out of the way so that you don't have to face that regular school year process and have to deal with that issue. That's one of the many issues that a minority person has to go through, so that there is some relevant data that you can look at in terms of what school districts go through for their PE departments. Is probably the highest attended classroom that most school districts have. It's not uncommon for PE classes to, you hear the discussion of pupil-teacher ratios of 25 to 30. It's not uncommon for PE classes to run 70 or 80. It, I'm sure if you went and looked at the statistical data for each school district, you would encounter a very similar correlation that would sustain the fact that there is a growth determinant issue that would, in particular, impact a minority student. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and I'm just looking and not really seeing that on either of the groups of why students leave. Maybe I'm missing it. And it's something that is, you know, I mean, obviously it's extremely relevant, and I'm just highlighting it for the administration. And the future of these roundtables, that if we have something that hasn't even, I mean, I see stress and peer pressure, but as far as identifying something as directly as that, I think we really need to make sure that we flag that and do it if it's even, you know, and I have no idea what percentage of students that is, if it revolves around mainly minority students or if it's a full spectrum, but I really appreciate that question and that response, because, you know, it's not in any of, I don't see it in any of our data in group one or group two, and so yeah, Carl.
Mr. Chairman, just Carl Rose. Just to shed some light on this issue, in human beings, we have a tendency to gravitate to our strengths. Okay? And those areas that we have strengths in, we're very comfortable in, we're competent in, we're confident in. When kids go to school, a lot of times they are ostracized because they're not competent, because they don't read at a certain level. If you go to elementary schools where young people are asked to stand up and read, you notice real quick the kids who have dyslexia and how uncomfortable that is for them. But this idea of being placed in a setting, in a system that is maybe foreign to you, and is very uncomfortable because you're out of your comfort zone, really is an issue. And I think we put PE in that category, but it's across the board. You're asking kids, young people, to go into an institution where they may or may not have some strengths, and some of them are very uncomfortable. And as you well know, people will make decisions to protect themselves. And I think you need look no further than the inability of some people to cope with their lack of success in a host of areas. So, you know, so how do you go about doing that? I tell you what, this you know, to get young people comfortable with even conversing. You'll be surprised how many kids you'll pass on the street. They'll try to ignore you, and you may not even say anything to them. And as long as we keep doing that, the cycle goes on. I mean, there are young people in schools who feel that nobody cares about them. They don't know their names, they don't talk to them, and they feel uncomfortable. So I'll stop there. But I think you brought up a specific with physical education, but I think it's across the board in schools. How comfortable do our children feel within the system that we've developed? And it is a factor.
And some of that might go to our measurement of competitive measurement instead of individual achievement, and I don't know whether, you know, we can get there, but we have boxes that we're putting folks in, so it's tough when we're talking about boxes, and we structure our school system as boxes and as classes, and that's where we put the value in the end. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Fleck or Mr. Soboloff. I don't know which one of you wants to answer it. But the comments that you elicited, and they're printed out here, one of them starts out, I just retired from working with Native Alaskan students in the high school. And this person wrote several pages of suggestions, including tribally funded social workers in the schools, tribally funded social workers available to families, tribally or federally funded counselors to mentor, encourage, advocate, tribal truancy officers, and tribes who link payouts to academic performances. And they're describing things that have happened in other communities in other states. I thought it was really interesting that the writer was specifically mentioning tribally funded. And, of course, you know, if you're going to hear expert testimony on any issue, you always want to say, well, who's paying you before you, as part of how you evaluate the testimony. And I'm kind of wondering if you see that this is important, where the money comes from in terms of who's doing the work.
The tribally funded means it would be coming from the federal government. And, well, the Alaska Native Brotherhood, Grand Camp, and many of the other local camps, we value education. Grand Camp has had a scholarship program for many years. In this case, I have no problem where, you know, tribal members are using the tribal government to assist and improve their educational opportunities. Central Council of Tlingit Haida, which Sasha is employed by, he teaches GED students, dropouts, or, you know, and the tribal government is with Phyllis Carlson is the one that did this joint venture grant with the Juneau School District. You will find Sea Alaska Heritage Institute has been instrumental in developing the not only the curriculum taught in all of Southeast, far as, you know, what the state requires, far as state education. I know that SHI has contributed greatly to it. You'll find that the Native community has been incredibly helpful and working with the school district, at least here in Juneau. I know probably in Ketchikan and Sitka as well. We would continue working on that.
So,
okay. Representative Gardner, I want to make sure that we have time for Sasha and for Karen to make a presentation to us. So,
briefly, the fact that all of this is federally funded is just because that's where funding was found, not because it has different value if the money comes than if the money comes from the state?
No.
Okay. No. Thank you.
Sasha, can you go ahead and give us your perspective?
Thanks. Seaton, through the chair to Representative Keller, who had asked at our very initial setting the comment about what the definition of a Carnegie unit is, and it is this. It is seat time. If you spend 120 hours in a chair, you get one credit. Okay, that equates through the reg, that equates through most educational institutions in America, and that's what drives the whole discussion, what you could do with it from that point on. So I appreciate the opportunity, Chairman Seaton, to come and contribute to this discussion, and I'll do it in a very distinctive way, although you have to overlook the fact that I am a social studies teacher by background. You know, once you're a teacher, you're always a teacher. I'm a mom and dad, all in one package rolled up. But I'll do it in a very distinctive way. I appreciate the opportunity, and on behalf of my dad, Dr. Walter Soboleff, and my mom, Genevieve Soboleff, God rest her soul, that she and my dad allowed me to be on this earth during this time period to talk about how learning is affected, particularly for Alaska Natives. I'm in my 39th year in this process, undergraduate from Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon, first master's degree from Seattle University in school administration, second master's in the religion world, having graduated from Dubuque Theological Seminary in Dubuque, Iowa. Started work here in the state of Alaska in 1970. Started teaching in Cape prior to their school being built. Have spent the rest of the time working with students, primarily students who are involved in the learning. A couple things have surfaced as a result of this endeavor to be successful. I, like Mr. Rose, came through the Juneau school system. It's a playground now, but that was the school called Capel School that I attended. And I was a member of the Bluebird Reading Group. The Bluebird Reading Group back then was the group that didn't quite get it, had a little bit of time struggling with English, and you understand it. So I have great empathy with Mr. Rose and what his experience has been. Secondly, one of the things that struck me, having done work in the public sector and in the tribal sector in working with students, was to learn about the history of Alaska. And you need to hear this part of the history. Prior to the 1800s, when Alaska was owned by the Russian territory, their initial schools were taught primarily by the Russian Orthodox priests. And they came in all the small rural villages and established their churches and converted many of their constituents. And the buildings are still there today, where they translated their Bible in the local tongue and dialect. And the most successful schools in the early 1800s were the Russian Orthodox schools. Very successful, because they empowered the students and their parents in that process. Well, roll ahead a few years, and in 1885, there was a man named Sheldon Jackson. You may have heard of him. He started a school in Sitka. He happened to have been the first commissioner of education, and as most politicians, he had deep pockets back in Washington, D.C., and he declared at that time, in 1885, we're going to have education in Alaska. I went, yay. And he said, but we're going to do it in English. I went, what? And our culture said, what? Well, that affords us the opportunity, if you roll the time frame forward to today in 2009, why I, as an Alaska Native, am speaking to you in English. It's not my native tongue. It's a cultural imprint that I don't have, but I have had to learn. And evidence by the record shows that there are successful Native Alaskans who figure the system out and who succeed. Mr. Rose is a striking evidence of that success. And there are thousands of other Alaska Natives who haven't figured it out. And that's the problem that we're dealing with, this particular issue having to deal with a dropout. I'm going to lay the card on the table for you as lawmakers to understand that in learning, doesn't make any difference whether you're black, pink, brown, or white, you have a certain skill set you have to obtain in order to be successful. Sometimes you can tack it on a high school qualifying exam. Sometimes you can tack it on attending school for a certain period of time. Sometimes you can tack it on to the achievement of a GED. But generally, it surfaces in the realm of being able to survive, which is the word I've heard here, that process. If you are going to talk in terms of surviving the process, you must understand that the cultural imprint that most Alaska Native people bring to the educational learning setting is very, very different than even in the structure of the English language itself, which basically is when we speak and when we write, nouns come first, followed by action words, they're called verbs, followed by adjectives and so on. The cultural pattern that most Alaska Native students and their parents and grandparents bring is the pattern that is the reverse of that. Their thought are the action words, the descriptive words, followed by the nouns. And therein is more or less the crux of the problem. Graduated from J.D. High in 1963, do your math, I was very honored to get out of that institution with a 1.735 grade point average. I could barely read, could barely write. Didn't figure it out until my freshman year at the University of Alaska Fairbanks when I had one of those, I get it, moments when I was in Bonehead 101 English, Bonehead 101 math, Bonehead, one-on-one social studies, to try to bring my skills levels up. And in that dialogue, I have found in the 39 years of working with parents, students, and teachers, and the teaching process, that the most significant card that is omitted in the educational learning for Alaska Natives is the card that the only skill they bring to the learning setting is the ability to gather information by what they see and what they hear. Those are the only skills, and those two skills are not addressed formally in the educational setting. Sure, we have other things that the educational practitioners will tell you. We have those who are tactile learning, those who deal with movement, those. But you must understand, this cultural imprint that I have has been here for thousands of years because it was long before paper. We learned it once. We learned it because we were taught by what we saw and what we heard by our culture. And if we can capitalize on it in the learning setting, I think I think the state of Alaska would have something. I'll give you a concrete example of that because I know that's how you think. In the early 70s, I was superintendent in Heidelberg, and we were getting our lunch program going for our 100 plus kids there. And at the same time, we were working on getting a cable system there, not knowing what was going to happen. I would meet the students in the morning for their breakfast, and they would come in droves because that was the food that they would have for the day. It was on a Wednesday. Wednesday, it was a normal breakfast. Hey, how are you doing? Great. Good to see you here. We're ready to go. Wednesday night, we threw the switch on the cable system that went into all the homes, and it forever changed that community. The next morning in the breakfast, I was stunned. Those kids knew every commercial, word by word, could sing the song and identify the skill set that was trying to be transmitted by TV. And I looked at our teachers and I said, you know, we've missed something here. Why is it that we're not able to do that excitement and that TV did? Roll the tape forward, 2009. The skill set of the Alaska Native student doesn't make any difference whether you're Yupik, Eskimo, Aleut, Tlingit, Haida, Tsimshian is still the same. We bring to the table the skill to be able to learn whatever is required of us by what we see and what we hear. You must change the pedagogy in your teaching practitioner process to acknowledge that skill set. As a state, you've done a very good job of being able to delineate what is successful and what is not successful, but what has not taken place is to understand that that skill set is being excluded in that process. And every community, every family that has that particular skill set has not been embraced. E.E. Cummings, who's a research analyst, the history will show you that the most significant impact that they can have to change a system is to empower the student and their parent. It's no longer just reading, writing, arithmetic, 8 to 5, we're done, Monday through Friday, have a good day. It doesn't happen that way. These students and their parents are here to learn. And it is our responsibility as Alaskans to look at every solution that is in existence and, more importantly, to look at it from the perspective that you may not find it the first time, but please don't look at it until you think you found something wrong and therefore it would negate everything. You must open it to the level so that if you have a child that is struggling, to help them. And I say to you in front of this group that the battle for getting success at the secondary level is not at the secondary level. It is at the third and second grade level. That is where the active practitioner mind becomes and sets the stage for the rest of their life. If you run into a teacher that just goes boom, get out of my way, you're done. Or if you run into a teacher that just absolutely captures your mind and your initiative and your willingness to learn something new, you will be successful as a learner. As a parent, I have seen and actually had to go into the first grade classroom and take on that system and said, you're not going to do that to my kid. I had to prove to the system that they were capable of learning and that they were excited in that learning process. So on behalf of the minorities of the school system, I really think that it is not okay to enter into a school system with the predisposition that if you don't get 6 credits before your sophomore year, you're gone. I don't think that's the way the state of Alaska should view the success of that thing, because the historic documents and the data will reflect that in a school district, if you enter 500 in year one of entering freshmen, and then 4 years later after they've put seat time in, and you graduate 330, where have the other ones gone? Well, I'll tell you where they've gone. I'm teaching at Central Council in the GED class where I've set up this program to do, just like the gentleman here, find out what's wrong. And the first thing I say to those students that come into that classroom, you know, you are not the problem. The moment I say that, a whole demeanor changes. At our GED class, we feed them, we give them rest, we give them breaks, we welcome them, and then we say, let's teach you how this thing goes. It started out with 2 people. We are now up to 12 a day. So as a practitioner, having spent some time in the profession from teaching to administrating to being on school boards and active in teachers and learning setting, please, there is a skill set that we bring, seeing and hearing. That's the only skill set we bring. Don't dismiss it. Embrace it and capitalize on it so that it will become an easy thing. And then the rest of this dropout history that will go will eventually pan out the way that it's supposed to. Because generally, school districts know how to run school districts. Teachers generally know how to teach. But the students who come there, those are the reason why we dedicate our time in schools, dedicate our time in parent groups, dedicate our time to make sure success happens to them. And it's not just to the minorities. It is to all the students who have all of the same impact. And they have skill sets. But we need to do a better job at capitalizing and addressing the needs in this case, at this issue, on this time, regarding those who have not survived the regular educational classroom setting and they are dropping out. And I would be happy to entertain any further questions from the committee members, and I thank you for this opportunity.
Well, that's great. I sure appreciate that. It's a perspective that we need to hear, and the schools, you know, where we're that's our responsibility, is to look at the schools and try and figure out how they can more adequately address the residents of Alaska. And I think that we have been looking at trying to, whether it's Moore versus Alaska, you know, the case that's going on in the upper areas, and finding out what is it that's not working and how it is that we can get there. And I am fully in agreement with where you're coming from. It's not the kid, the box we're trying to put them in, and how do we get there? What is it that we need to do for those individuals to go forward and to blossom and succeed? So I sure appreciate your testimony. Are there questions? Representative Book.
Before these gentlemen leave, you know, we've got this opportunity today in, you know, looking at some of the things that we have seen work. We're doing it kind of retrospectively. We have a military youth academy that's doing wonders with dropouts. That's after the fact. So you're talking about second and third grade. Some of us are looking at ways that we can incorporate our children in a system that recognizes birth to death is actually education. Now, without mandating education for, you know, babies into, you know, kindergarten, you know, truly the community involvement, I think, is the essence of where we need to start. How can, in your minds, we begin the process so that at second and third grade, we really start to work a better solution here?
Josh.
Through the chair, Representative Wood, thank you very much. Much of the research that we look at, which basically comes out of ERIC, it's a nationally recognized research institute for education, really reveals a very simple answer to your question. It puts right at the heart of the decision-making process, how do schools become successful? Schools become successful, according to that research, and in actuality, when the parents and the students are involved in the educational process. You'll recall, in the American system, we are in a process of now wondering, holy cow, what's going on? Because our process came as a result of the Industrial Revolution. That's why we are like we are. Well, holy smokes, in the 21st century, we're not like that. What we're about is capitalizing on the skills that students have today and to make it better, to make it be a better learning process. We're all about the same age. I learned typing when I was a senior in high school. You know, that was the standard. Well, guess what, folks? In the 21st century, my sixth grade daughter types faster than I do. We need to change the process that we have so that it can encompass the parents and the students in that learning. Because too long has gone the process where the parent says, I'm going to deliver my child to the door, the rest of it's up to you. Doesn't work. I've spent 13 years as an assistant principal at this high school, tell you that process doesn't work. If it does, well, I've sure spent a lot of time talking to 9,000 kids and their parents over 12 years. What works is bringing the parents into the school and to do something positive with them. If you don't do something positive with them, they will continue to stay away. And in the small state of Alaska, with the amount of money that we have supporting this process, you need to accommodate the parents in that school. You need to accommodate them. You cannot exclude them and just invite them in for a parent-teacher conference. Folks, that's not going to cut it. They need to be there. They need to be enforcing. They need to be just visually present so that their child knows and their peers know that they are involved in that process. Us sitting in this room, we are here probably because someone took a positive step on our behalf and said, you know, nice job. We don't hear those words enough, do we? Nice job. And so that message need to be conveyed on the state level that sure we have unions, sure we have custodians, and sure we have certified teaching staff, but you need to recognize that in the minority setting, which is an overwhelming number in this state, that what we are about is family. What we are about is our mom and dad, our aunts and uncles. And those are the ones who support us. If you exclude them, you give us no choice but to fail. And we are demonstrating that overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. So you need to shift the paradigm of what we're doing in terms of learning and teaching.
Thanks. Representative Munoz?
Thank you, Sasha. That was a powerful testimony. You have your father's gift for communication. It's great to see you here today. I was curious. I've been involved with the Alaska Native Sisterhood, and one of the issues that the sisterhood has identified as a hurdle for success is the compulsory attendance age. Could you just comment on the current law, and would a change or could a change have impact on graduating more students?
Representative Munoz through the chair. I'll walk delicately on this eggshell because I know we have our commissioner here who will keep a very sharp eye on it. But as a rule of thumb, if you're between the ages of 14 and 18, and if you have an IEP, it goes up through age 21, the moment you leave the door of your house, the school's responsible for you, the bottom line. And they're responsible for you because you, as a student, need to attend school. Schools in our industrial complex had no problem. You just had to open the doors, and wow, they came in masses. Well, we open the doors nowadays, and we go, have I missed the opening time? And you need to ask yourself as a process, we need to go about that changing. We need to recognize that what's at play here is really a structure that says for a certain time period during your age from 14, 13 to 18, you're to be in school. Well, as a cultural person, that's in there, but not at that age group. My cultural imprint says to me this: when you're born and when you reach age 6 or 7, you're a child. And then from age 8 through about age 24, you're a young person. And then when you get to about 25 to age 30, you get to be a young adult. And when you're between 45 and 60, someone might pay attention to you because you know a little bit. And if you're 70 and over the hill, you can speak anytime you want. In the Western setting, it's very, very different. From age 0 to about age 7, that's okay, you're young. Age 8 to about 18, it's pretty good. For some of the minority groups, it's a big deal when you turn 16. In the American setting, who cares? It's not until you're 21 that allows you to have some status in the Western society. You can drink. Some states used to be you could vote, but you're voting earlier now. And there is a difference in the orientation to how the chronology of a cultural person is being affected by the Western society. It is a difference, but it's not a difference that should stop the ability for us to change and recognize that there are some variances of age. There are some variances in how we put a cap on at what level do you stop learning. Well, I would venture a guess in this room, I don't ever want to tell you no. No doesn't mean no for you. No means I'm going to find another way to do it. And that is the way that all of our students are. It's not no, oh, well, that's they wanted us to believe that. No, that's not the way it is. I have GED students now who have not had a class at all for 10 years or more. Said, can you come and do this? And I said, absolutely. I've also had students says, I've not been able to do my high school qualifying exam. Can you help me? Absolutely. So there is a time frame and a difference in the age group between the societies, and you need to be mindful of that, and it needs to be accounted for. Sure, it's black and white, and we're making decisions for all Alaskans, but it's not our fault. Sheldon Jackson said we're going to do it in English in 1885, okay?
I want to do, say, you know, we did have, we had an avant-garde Don Shackford online, and we talked with him the other day, so we're not going to be able to do that. We're really over time, but I would like to give Karen Martison, she's been online, a chance to share your thoughts with us, and I'm sorry that we've run out of time. 2 hours is obviously not enough, and for the committee, I wanted to make sure that we're reminded to bring this dropout package with us on Friday, because we're going to be considering some other things on this as well. So, Karen, are you still online?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Sorry we're getting so late into things, but it's been a very interesting conversation we've been having. Did you want to give us some thoughts there from Sitka?
Yes, I'd really appreciate that. I appreciate everyone else's comments, and the inquiries and questions, I think, are really productive. I've also been in education about 30 years, and during this time I've pretty much worked exclusively with youth who are, quote, at risk. But again, I'm not sure that's the correct term. A lot of them are not in school, haven't been in school. But again, I think they've been disempowered or have been failed to be embraced, as Mr. Sobolev indicated. This is a huge topic that you brought up. Some of us have been at the same table. We've seen reports and conversations for 30 years, on and on and on. So it makes me slightly nervous, because each time another report or another wave, you know, occurs, some little effort is made, some little thing happens, but we don't really wrap ourselves fully around it. It always seems to be kind of a hit and miss. So, and in the whole scheme, to me, there's two separate issues, and one is a whole systemic reform that prevents dropouts. And at the same time, we have a crisis right now, right today, with 4,000 dropouts this year, 4,000 last year, 4,000 the year before. We have 20,000, actually, in our state, 57,000 Alaskans who don't have a GED or a diploma, are unable to be productive. So while we need to work on dropout prevention, we also need an emergency response to young people who are not able to be productive and independent living adults. So those are our folks in jail. Those are our folks on public assistance. We have to address that. So while we could do our homework for another 30 years, I think it's time for an emergency response, just specific to those who are already dropped out. I have concerns about things like more compulsory years. Since the factory era of schooling and education in America, our model has basically been learn or I will hurt you. So the threatening approach is amazing. I'm not sure that's working, that we would keep threatening children to learn. I would rather see something along the lines of an option for all up to age 21, which increases our formula funding for our state, and many states are looking at this or have already gone to this. The other thing I would say about the dropouts, especially at that secondary level, but as Mr. Sobolev said, it has to be in grade 2 and 3, is that all students need to be given alternative paths, period. There has to be 5 ways to do every assignment. It can't be, this is the assignment and this is the book. And I would really encourage you to look at what some states are doing. Senator Davis had the meeting with the Education Commission of the states, and they are looking at some of the K-16 models. Some states and some countries are actually lowering the credit requirements to graduate, so that when the end of 10th grade comes and you have your 14 credits and you've passed the exam, you're now given options for the next 4 to 5 years until you're 21. You have the option to begin advanced placement in a college setting. You have the option to be in career and technical training. You have the option to be on the job or in a military setting. You have the option to be in service learning or in a remedial classroom to catch back up on your reading or writing. So I would be very frightened by compulsory things and laws versus options and alternative offerings to all young people. you know, we know a lot of the programs that are working, and some of those have mentioned, and some of those are, you know, early childhood. Some of those are things for middle schools, et cetera. When it comes to kids who have already dropped out, the things we're doing in the state, Job Corps, the Military Youth Academy, Youth Build, the alternative schools, the tech high schools, those work. We know they work. But our capacity in the state is really small. It's a few hundred at the Job Corps. It's 20 in Youth Build. There's some alternative schools. So we haven't built a system that could serve the number who want these alternatives. So that's something that our state would have to do. This is a very passionate issue for me. I've been a principal of an alternative school and run programs for dropouts now. And I'd like to kind of, I guess, just say again, there's two separate issues on the table, and one is to create a system for the future, and the other is to address a crisis today. And we need an emergency response for those who have already dropped out. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you, Karen. Really appreciate that. We are obviously faced with multiple problems. I'm hopefully, and I'm not just talking to you, Karen, we've been really looking at this early childhood piece and how to get it. I at least on this committee have been raising skepticism about the pilot program of basically 4-year-old kindergarten as being the way to engage. It seems that the testimony that we've had here of programs that are working, such as Parents as Teachers, and we had great a voluntary program in HUNA, and now has 80% participation, and that those kind of things that last not just through the kindergarten year, but through third grade, through sixth grade, right on up, because you're talking about engagement and learning styles and the value of education. We've had communities and schools talking about bringing in those other assets and basically some of those same things, parent involvement, community involvement. And then we have the basic question of, are our goals and incentives right in a Carnegie unit, in seat time, in the graduation, what we are valuing by having a graduation requirement based upon not acquisition or demonstration of skills, but on the minimal completion and having endured a certain amount of time. I think that those are complex issues, but they're pretty simple too, because at some point it's a policy decision of people of the state of Alaska and the representatives and senators coming together and saying, is the direction we've been in and the measurements that we're taking and the incentives we're giving correct for the citizens of the state? And so I think that that's what we're trying to do in this roundtable, is get a number of ideas, and we could have this discussion for a long time, and we need to, and we're going to continue it in this committee, because the basis, if we all decide that the Carnegie unit is the appropriate measure for what we want students to graduate and achieve, if that's going to be our measure, and as a policy decision, we make that decision, but we need to review that and see if that's where we think the state wants to go. I personally think that where the seat time has not served us particularly well, and but it's going to take a little more than one meeting here to resolve that and figure out how to get there. But I think that we need to back up to those basic policy decisions and evaluate them instead of just looking at, can we insert some portion of a policy here or some technique there to maintain. So I wanted to put that forward so that everyone knows that this conversation can't stop. We need this conversation to go forward, and I'm going to let Sasha kind of round out our round table today, but I hope that you will all individually engage with individual members of this committee and the committee as a whole, because we need the broad community of people that are not only educators and parents and students that are in school letting us know, and we have email, and anything that they send to me will be distributed through the committee. I know we've got a pretty thick packet now, but the gems that come in those emails and those suggestions and the knowledge of what's will help shape policy, I think, for the future. So, Sasha, do you want to give us the final words?
Chairman Seaton and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity and the honor to come here and participate. And for having the last word, you know, teachers always look at this for that moment, because this is the teachable moment. One of the things that it is really imperative is to make sure that as you plan the change that you're going to do, to look at it in its setting. American education traditionally has been very pendulum in its swing. You know, we've gone through in our time when we were one teacher, one classroom, to the pendulum on the other side where you had open classrooms and it was okay. And if you wanted to feel like learning, that was great. Well, that hasn't necessarily been cutting edge, because you have to understand in the perspective of the world of learning, the United States is about 21st from the top of systems that work and are productive in the world. Holland is the top of the line, and other European countries have figured this out. And I know we have the propensity to try to reinvent the wheel, but we need to take advantage of the things that have preceded us in the world of education and learning, and to know that we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just need to make sure that we're mindful of the participants in that learning situation, and that's really what it's all about. Because I know there's skill here. I know there's dedication and commitment here. I know that there's clarity of thought of what you need to do. But it's that student in that classroom interacting with the teacher and the peers in that classroom that are really at the heart of what Alaska should be doing for its students. Doesn't make any difference what color you are, or whether you're rural or whether you're urban. It's that interaction of classroom student-teacher relationship, and that should be the crown jewel of that learning process, because you came as a result of something that encouraged you to examine this and be successful. And we need to share that wealth with the rest of the state. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And we will, of course, be receptive, like I said, to additional thoughts from any of you and other folks across the state. And I hope that as other forums go forward to look at these problems, feel free to invite committee members, because it's helpful if we have you know, that give and take consultation as we go forward in other forums as well. So thank you very much, and it is 10:30, and we are adjourned.